Welcome and thank you for holding. At this time, your lines are in a listen-only mode. A public comment period is scheduled to take place after the opening remarks. If you are interested in commenting on today's topic, you may press star 1 on your phone at any time to be placed into queue. There is a limited time set aside for public comment, so please keep your comments to less than 1 minute. Stating your name and affiliation when prompted is optional. However, please provide at least an identifying alias. This will assist in administering the session. You may also email comments to green.chemistry@dtsc.ca.gov. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Debbie Raphael. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you, operator. Well, welcome everyone on the call. Welcome to our Green Ribbon Science panel members, and thank you, Chair Bill Carroll, for leading us this morning, and welcome to all the people listening on the call. In the room with me, we have a group of DTSC people who will be introduced later on. I just wanted to say, as my first official duty for the Green Ribbon Science panel as a non-member, but officially as director of the department, that I am incredibly grateful for your work on this call and in advising us on how we're going to move forward on this really challenging piece of implementation, the alternatives assessment. When I envision back to that psychedelic flowchart that we all are so affectionately remembering together, the left-hand side of that flowchart of prioritization and issues of lists and such, while daunting, feels somewhat familiar. It's that right-hand side of that flowchart, that alternatives assessment part, that feels like we're indeed breaking new territory. We are inventing the wheel. While alternatives assessment has been done at various levels, it's never been a regulatory requirement. And so I think it's going to take all of our creative energies as well as the creative and expertise of our stakeholders to get this right. And I'm very much looking forward to hearing your thoughts on this first call on quality assurance as to how we make sure that the alternatives assessments are meaningful. They're not just paper exercises. So with that, I just want to thank you again, and I will now turn it over to Kathy.
Thank you very much. Welcome Green Ribbon Science Panel members as well as members of the public. I'm going to do a brief roll call for the science panel members, and then we're going to introduce the staff, and then I have a couple of words about the public comment section of this meeting. So as a roll call, Bill Carroll.
Did you hear me? I'm here.
Thank you. J.J.?
Here.
Dale Johnson?
Here.
Joe Goose?
Here.
Lauren Hine?
Here.
Todd Delaney?
Here.
And Bob Peoples?
Here.
And besides me in the room, I'll start to my right.
Jeff Long.
Odette Madriago.
Debbie Raphael.
Hortensia Muniz.
Corey, yes. Radhika Majer.
Paul Hadley.
Colleen Heck.
Thank you. And before we go to Bill with an agenda review and introduction to this morning's meeting, I want to make a couple of comments about making public comments for those of you that are listening this morning. First of all, we are not manning the green chemistry mailbox this morning, so please do not send a comment into the mailbox to be read into the record this morning in the meeting. So, again, we're not manning that, and I forgot to take it out of the facilitator's agenda, so I just want to let you know that you'll need to call and make your public comment over the phone. And speaking to that, if you don't need to wait until we get to the public comment portion of the agenda. If you know you want to make a public comment, it's really helpful to us if you go ahead and just press star one, and get into the queue so that we can better manage that section. All right, with that said, I'll turn it back over to Bill.
Very good. Thank you, Kathy, and welcome to all colleagues from the Green Ribbon Science panel. We have topic number 3, which curiously enough is coming in the order. Since it is a discrete topic, it doesn't really matter too much that we take things out of order. This has to do with quality assurance for alternatives assessments. As GRSP members, you've seen questions 3A to 3E that we nominated as conversation starters. What I would like to do with this agenda today is to take those pretty much in order, and I also have a few sub-questions that I'd like to ask and more or less take in order to get your thoughts on them. At the end, we're going to have the same kind of homework assignment idea as we had in the last round of calls. And so you can be thinking about it. What I would be hoping that you would do with your homework is, to whatever extent we get through the questions today, and I think we can get through a fair number of these, that you would create a document of no more than about 3 minutes reading that will summarize the things that we talked about, and I'll review this at the end as the sort of questions that I'd like you to address in your homework. We will use that on the next call as a way of restarting the conversation and refreshing people's memories as to where we were in this conversation. I think it will also be a help for Debbie and DTSC in terms of raw material on what our ideas are at that point. So that's the short review. We've had our introductions. We are now at 9:40, so we're a bit ahead of schedule. Unless there's something else that we should do with the agenda, I'd like to turn it over to Odette for the document review.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you, Bill. I'll try to keep this fairly short because, as always, we most want to hear from all of you. So just a little bit of, you know, background on this topic, and we've talked about this a little bit before. This has certainly been a major issue in many of the public comments that we received last year on the various versions of the regulations, and it's been a very challenging one for us, which is why we in particular wanted input on this topic from the GRASS. We are anticipating that many, if not most, alternative assessments will actually be performed by the product manufacturer or someone acting on the product manufacturer's behalf, as opposed to a third party that makes everything publicly available. And we also expect that there will be significant portions of the alternative assessment data and analysis that will be subject to trade secret or CBI protection claims. And the next factor is that while many people have said, well, DTSC, we would like to see you do an in-depth analysis for quality assurance of all alternatives assessment, I think at this point, finally, everyone has come to realize that DTSC is not going to have the resources to do that. So in light of all that, there's many stakeholders who are calling upon us to come up with a solution to include in the regulations that addresses the question of how do we ensure the integrity and the quality of these alternatives assessments. So as Debbie says, that they are meaningful documents. So that's what we've called all of you together to review. For this particular topic, there are just two attachments. The first one, attachment 3.1, is just a copy of the portion of the statutes that pertains to alternatives assessment. If you've read it, you'll see there's nothing in here giving us any kind of guidance on quality assurance, so we're kind of on our own here. The second attachment, 3.2, is an excerpt from the September version of the draft regulation, and I want to underscore that this was just the draft regulations, nothing that's in effect, and it should just be viewed as a source of ideas that you may want to consider and approaches. You can take pieces of this, meld it together with other ideas you may have, or push this all the way aside and come up with something new. We're looking for some creativity here. So with that, I'm going to turn to the questions, and I'm just going to highlight the main questions, and Bill, as he is facilitating this, will dig deeper on each question with some sub-questions that will stimulate the discussion. In looking at this, your chair came up with some kind of key points for possible quality intervention. And those four points would be information and sources, practitioners assembling the information, post hoc checking of assembled assessments and conclusions and underlying formulation information. And I think the word in here, assembled, is key. And I think what that recognizes is that the performance of alternatives assessments and verifying their quality will probably be more challenging when we're talking about an assembled product as opposed to a formulated product. And then the final point would be documentation. So we have four main questions that we're posing to you today. Question 3A, should there be qualification requirements for persons conducting alternatives assessments? And when we talk about qualifications requirements, what we typically think of are education requirements, experience, training. Should there be some sort of a certification or licensing requirement? Question 3B, under what circumstances, if any, should the regulations require the review and verification of an alternative assessment by an independent third party? And when we say independent, we mean somebody who is truly unaffiliated with the manufacturer or consortium of manufacturers that's been involved in preparation of the alternatives assessment, so that they would be a completely neutral party. Question 3C, what should be included in alternatives assessment work plans submitted to DTSC in advance of the commencement of the alternatives assessment itself? As you may recall, I think not only the two prior versions of the draft regulations, but probably the outline as well, included the concept of manufacturers submitting some type of a work plan to DTSC, which, again, DTSC will not have the resources to do an in-depth review, but this was just intended to be an initial check. Are they on the right track? Does it look like what they're proposing is going to meet the requirements of the statute and the regulations? So this question I've tossed out there, is there any way that something like a work plan can be used as a preliminary measure in assuring quality? Maybe yes, maybe no. Want to hear your thoughts on that. Question 3D, to the extent DTSC does have resources available to audit AAs, what should be the focus of those audits? And again, the availability of resources is very much a question up in the air, so we should not make assumptions that there will be extensive resources. But to the extent we can do post audits, it would be good to hear your thoughts on how we should focus those audits. And finally, if you have any other related ideas that we haven't thought of or captured in these questions, that would be really good to hear. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Bill. And the staff and I are here to answer any questions that it may help, you know, provide clarification or help with your thought processes. Bill?
Thank you, Odette. And I'm going to say the same grace that you usually say on a conference call. A fair amount of extraneous noise that sounds like papers shuffling. So to the extent possible, if you can keep your phone on mute when you're not making an intervention, it will probably make it easier for everyone else, although I recognize that that's difficult to do all the time. At this point on the agenda, we have the public comment. It's technically scheduled for 10:10 to 10. And I'm going to ask for a little guidance here, since in the past we've had people show up a little bit late for the public comment. I'm going to ask for that comment now so we can start our discussion. But Kathy or Debbie, perhaps you can advise me. For anyone who gets in the queue up till 10:30, we would honor at some point the opportunity to make a public comment. At least that's my suggestion. How do you feel about that from the state's perspective?
Bill, this is Kathy. We don't don't actually have a set time frame for this, so it's okay for us to go ahead through the agenda as it's written.
Okay, that's fine. Then let's go ahead and check for a public comment. Through the physical locations, first in California, is there anyone there physically wanting to make public comment?
Not here at DTSC.
Not at DTSC?
There's no one here at the Berkeley Center for Green Chemistry.
No.
So then for any of the other GRSP members at your physical locations, there is no one here in Dallas, surprisingly.
No one here in Juneau.
you're there in Juneau, but this is Bob. There's no one in Atlanta.
Dale, no. Nobody in Emeryville.
Okay.
No one in Denver.
Sounds to me like there's no one at any of the physical locations. So then I guess at this point we'd want to see if there are people on the phone. Operator, can you help here? Do we have people wanting to comment?
Yes. At this time, if you would like to provide comments to the Green Ribbon Science Panel subcommittee members on today's topic, please press star 1 and ensure your line is not muted. You will be prompted to record your name. Stating your name and affiliation is optional. However, providing at least an identifying alias will assist us in managing the session. Again, pressing star 1 will enable you to join the queue and make a comment. If you wish to be removed from the queue, press star 0. One moment while we wait for our first comment.
Or in the queue for making comment.
Our first public comment comes from John Ulrich. Your line is open.
Thank you, operator. Good morning, members of the panel. Can you hear me?
John, this is Odette. We just wanted to quickly ask how many people are in the queue. It will help us orchestrate this.
Right now, there's 3.
Thank you. Sorry, John.
Thank you, Odette.
So the limitations here, we've usually limited this to 1 minute, John. Is that okay?
Yes, that's fine, Bill. Thank you. Just very quickly, my name is John Ulrich. I'm the executive director of the California Chemical Industry Council, and I'm the co-chair of the Green Ribbon Science Panel, or pardon me, the Green Chemistry Alliance. I wanted to just let you know that with regard to third-party involvement in alternatives assessment, the Green Chemistry Alliance was on the record as early as June of 2009 as indicating that this is a position that we support under certain circumstances. And again, it's wherein the DTSC, after review of the alternatives assessment, determines that there's some inadequacy or deficiency that the manufacturer or retailer is unable to remedy. However, by September of 2010, the concept of third-party verifications and assessors had morphed into something that was large-scale and bureaucratic morass, and it became mandatory on all parties, regardless of their capability or the complexity of the alternatives assessment. It promised to add significant cost and delay. The Green Chemistry Alliance submitted considerable comment regarding the September proposal, and we found that the material that you have in front of you today for review is seriously defective, and I refer you to the Green Chemistry Alliance comments of November 1st and December 3rd, 2010, which you can find on www.greenchemistryalliance.org. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, John. Operator, next call.
The next question is from John Sharp.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, my comments. So I work with Triquint Semiconductor in Hillsboro, Oregon, and I'd just like to make a comment on the part of the code, section 25253, and in particular section C of that. This has been something that we've commented on throughout this process, and that when we hear this alternatives assessment, we'd agree with the previous speaker that this thing is grown way out of any proportion. And when you come back to the law as written, it says that the department shall also make every feasible effort to devise simplified and accessible tools that we all can use And when you go out onto this alternatives assessments by third parties and then being checked by a second third party, this is not making an effort to make a simplified and accessible tool that all of us can easily use. So if you, we would encourage the panels to come back to the law on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Operator, next comment.
The next public comment comes from Davis Balt. Your line is open.
Yes, good morning. Davis Balt from the Exchange Coalition California for a Healthy and Green Economy. And two quick comments. First of all, the second question that Odette posed, what circumstances, if any, require review by unaffiliated third parties? I think that while the statute, as was mentioned, is looking for a simplified solution that will be practical, there does need to be some mechanism whereby the alternatives assessment work is reviewed. We can't just assume that a vested interest will always come up with something that doesn't need to have additional scrutiny. So as change is involved, as we move forward, which we plan to be, we will be paying more attention to this. And the second quick comment is that I think these public comment periods, you know, it's hard to say too much in 1 minute, but in addition to perhaps lengthening the time for people to comment, I think it's also would be useful if the public comment period could happen later in the calls so that we can react to the conversation among the Green Ribbon Science panel. So thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Operator, are there any other commenters waiting?
There are no further comments at this time.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Thank you, Operator, and thank you to all the commenters. So let's go ahead and get into our discussions. There are a number of ways that we could go about this. There seem to be a number of variables that we're going to have to address, but a couple that stand out to me are things related to people, things related to the process. And it's entirely possible that those two aren't. There are certainly aspects to either when you're talking about how you would go about creating a quality assurance process. The other thing that I would hope that we could do, and I think it's probably something that the experts on this panel can speak to, is to the extent that we're able to understand what has been done with respect to quality assurance in these kinds of processes, the more we're able to draw from existing expertise, I think the closer we'll get to a credible process. And in that, I wanted to start with this question for those of you out there who are familiar with this. What's required by other standard-setting organizations? Are there best practices for the qualification requirements in terms of, as you see, education, experience, training, and so on? What do other organizations do? And these could be standard organizations like ISO or ASTM or NSF or other voluntary standards organizations. What's the typical process, and who'd like to start?
Bill?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Todd. If nobody else is wanting to start, I mean, one of the things that's interesting along this line, I've spent the last, I guess, about 5 years of my ISO career working on two standards, one which deals with competency, which is the issue that you were just talking about, which is a combination of education, training, and other parameters, and how do you go about setting up a organization that would do third-party verification work that would then be monitored by an outside entity. The outside entity in this case is ANSI, the American National Standards Institute, and I noticed in the draft regs that folks had referred to Guide 65. There is a standard out there called the ISO 14065, which deals primarily with greenhouse gas validators and verifiers for projects. And when we set that standard up, we set it up so that it could be used for all different kinds of sectors, and it relies on a competency standard that then brings in the competency of the verifiers. And you can set that whole program up in two different ways. One, where in this particular one, ANSI is the body that accredits the verification organization. The verification organization then uses the ISO standard along with the competency standard to train their people, record their people, and do all the things that you need to do to set out a team. And one of the things I wanted to bring up early on, you won't be able to do an alternatives analysis by a single individual. There will have to be a lead, but then there will have to be team members that can either be experts or other verifiers to go through it, because one person just can't have all the competencies that are needed. And so you've got the standard run by, say, ANSI, and you can then make that work in two different ways. One, with the California Air Resources Board. The California Air Resources Board continues to oversee ANSI and oversee the process, can go along on any of the audits when we as a verification body are audited, can go along on any of the site visits and essentially monitor what ANSI is doing, but can have does not have to have all of the staff necessary to actually run the programs. Or you can have it the way the California Air Resources Board does it, where essentially they have all the functions of ANSI housed within the Air Resources Board, but are using basically the same standards to guide them in terms of how people are verified or validated. And I've worked personally on these kind of programs for probably the last 6 years, and I was the international convener on this competency standard. And so I've got a number of the issues that were brought up by DTSC this morning and are going to continue to be brought up in their regs have already been issues that have solutions to them, not necessarily what everybody likes, but there are solutions out there. So anything I can be helpful with on that, I will be glad to do that.
Todd, I'd like, if you would, please, if there's something that's shorter than an encyclopedia, if there is a summary of the competency standards that you could send around to the group for reference, I think we'd all appreciate seeing it. And I'd like to ask a clarifying question, if I could. The competency standard relates to, and I'm going to use what we would do in this case, and it may not be exactly where it's come from, but would it relate to the people who do the alternatives assessment in the first place, or third-party validators afterwards, or both?
It could be done as both. I, as a consultant in the greenhouse gas arena, follow and have those same competencies for my team when we're doing the work on a project, an offset project. We have those same competencies for the people that are going to then be reviewing that offset project. And we also have, as was in the regs, an independent internal reviewer that then is part of the team but does not take part in any of the team functions till the end. And the internal reviewer makes sure that all of the necessary things have been accomplished. They don't redo the work, but they make sure that nothing has been missed. And so the competency standard was set up so that you could qualify teams of individuals for doing both the verification and for doing the actual work. And the way 66 was set up, you can put in there any different kind of sector that you want, but the competency requirements are general, and you then have to, it's more of how do you put that down in terms of a database? How do you know how they've got it? How do you check the people? And what's the mechanism for ensuring that, in fact, the team members have the competency?
Thank you, Todd. And it also will probably matter as to the complexity of what gets devised for an alternatives assessment versus the complexity of the work that's being done there as well. There may be some modulation that would be required. Bob Peoples, I want to call you out on this because I know you've done a fair amount of work on standards with NSF. What's required in order to handle this, do a standard for NSF, either in your carpet experience or what you imagine in the green chemistry standard?
Well, I think the answer, first of all, I appreciate Todd's comments and look forward to seeing the resource that he referred to in terms of that competency standard, because I think it could go a long way in moving us down this path and not reinventing the wheel. So one observation there. The second thing I would tell you is that this whole area engendered great debate, as is not a surprise to the folks on this committee, both during the development of the carpet standard and in the ongoing right now development of the greener chemical product and process standard, which we hope will be released by the end of June, if not sometime in July. It's in CPHC review right now. So part of the issue here is that there are third parties out there who have been established by reputation over time that are considered credible for doing these independent third party, either conducting alternative assessments or auditing the alternative assessments. There's been no formal mechanism in the standards that we've worked on thus far that says you have to be certified under the ANSI umbrella or you have to meet the competencies of the ISO standard at this point in time for those standards that we're working on. The converse to that is I think that a lot of the constituents, and there is a split here as well, feel like that there does need to be some type of an independent check and balance that takes place, and we've talked about what we refer to as desk audits, which are minimally invasive, if I can use that term, analysis of the materials and the data that are submitted to make sure that they're complete and that they sort of pass the smell test or that they're logical or consistent with good science. The second was through the statistical audit approach where you have an independent auditor that will go out and actually go through the books, if you will. If I refer back to the carpet standards in particular, I'm well aware of documentation that's as much as 2 4-inch binders thick in terms of all the data that was pulled together, both from the manufacturing facility and to the extent that was possible back through the supply chain, and the auditor would go in and statistically audit the details in those compilations. I'm not aware that anybody's ever gone through anything beyond a statistical audit. So the analogy is a little bit like a financial audit at that particular point in time. And if you find an inconsistency, then you move forward with a more in-depth analysis.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Lauren, for DFE, are there requirements for people who do assessments there?
Absolutely. And, again, like Bob was saying, it's not an ANSI process, but you can take the best of the principles behind an ANSI process to ensure quality of reviewers. And so the requirements for becoming a chemical profiler for DFE include technical competence. You need to demonstrate that you have the staff, that you have the assessment and interpretation abilities, that you can access and manage hazard information, you can use estimation models and software, that you can handle proprietary business information securely. You need to show elements of credibility and good standing. And you need to do pilots. You need to undergo several pilot product assessments in order to sort of be mentored by DFE in the process. And that allows a sort of a period of adjustment, which I think is very important. And then it's a fairly, the way DFE does it is they have, right now they have 2 authorized profilers. One is NSF International, one is TOC Services for their DFE Safer Product Labeling Program. And DFE provides kind of oversight for them. And this is very important, and I think something that will come up in our later discussion is that in whatever ways this system can be set up to share non-proprietary information and to leverage work that's being done would be advantageous, because reasonable toxicologists often disagree. So if you have one organization saying the aquatic toxicity is, say, 9 parts per million and the other says it's 11, that could be significant in terms of a threshold, for example, for GHS classification, but it's not a huge difference in terms of which literature you look at. So sometimes DFE plays a kind of arbitration role that allows two profilers to come to agreement and to make sure everybody's looking at the same data. So I just want to make that point now, and I'll make it again later, that yes, indeed, they have important qualification requirements and a review pilot that is very helpful and that may be helpful to the state as well.
Thanks, Lauren. Jay, Dale, Joe, any other organizations that you work with that might add some perspective?
Yeah, this is Jay. Well, number one, I like to have an opportunity to review the TAS competence standard. You know, my environment is with respect to assembling final products. Unfortunately, there are many processes and documents available, but most of them are pretty much proprietary, except that you know, in terms of number one, quality assurance and auditing usually follow more or less existing, you know, the American, the quality society documents, or maybe resorting to, in terms of regulation-wise, like RoHS, as well as WEE, the you know, the compliance documents. I really like to see TAS document in terms of competence, in terms of some so-called a standardized document, so that I can have a better input from you know, assembling the product side in terms of auditing as well as assessment. So,
and I let me augment that, Jay, that for Todd, I've already asked you for this, but Lauren and Bob, particularly if there are summaries of the approaches that have been used by other organizations, I think we'd love to have an opportunity to see them, because in just listening to this, first of all, without having them in front of me, it's difficult for me to know, but I have the sense that there is certainly a range of, and I'm going to use the word stringency, and that may be the wrong word, but there is certainly a range of, it seems to me, the amount of expertise that's necessary for the various aspects of this, and I think we'll want to be able to look at that range and then put it in the context of what we're doing here. So if I could ask you to make a note, and if you're capable of doing that without making it a career, I think that would be very helpful to us.
Sure. Should we send them to Odette?
Yes. I think that's the right answer. And Odette, you can tell me no, but I think that's probably the right answer, and then you could distribute them.
Please send it to both Kathy and myself.
Okay.
And if you don't get a reply from me, send me an email asking if I received it without the attachment. And I say this because I had a couple of problems with the last round where two people sent me documents with an attachment, and I didn't get it from them. And I have no problem getting other emails from it, but somehow the attachment was a problem. So.
Okay. Joe, Dale, anything to add here?
This is Joe. No, I don't, actually.
Dale?
Yeah, this is Dale. So I'm quite familiar with it from a toxicology standpoint, and this relates to both worker safety as well as regulations on submissions of data to EPA or any type of environmental body, or to for human health types of products. And so typically, the process is separated, and I'll just simplify it and say it's separated into two different categories. And one is relates to what we would call, for lack of a better word here, standard operating procedures. So in this particular case, it could relate to the tools that are developed or the tools that are in use. So it's a standard operating procedure that either companies or reviewing bodies and so forth use within a certain type of process. And then there is the individuals that actually do the quality assurance review to assess and then verify that who's ever using those tools has used them in the correct way, and there are actually standards for that, and it's documented along that. So it's not a scientific review per se. It's a quality assurance review that the actual standard operating procedures are in place, they're being used, and there's no variations from those. And that becomes quality assurance type of assessment. Those are done, those units can be in-house as well as by third-party reviewers. Then there's the scientific review, which takes a different type of review and let's call it quality assurance. That tends to fall into more of a peer review type of approach. And so it doesn't follow the typical here's the regulations, here's the procedures you're using and so forth. So it is more of a scientific type of review. The qualifications for those two different processes are really quite different. And the quality assurance for standard operating procedures and so forth is done on very specific types of training, qualifications in terms of education and experience within a particular field. And it's done through both through continuing education, and then there's certain types of assessment that occur over time that say the person is, in fact, still qualified, and they understand whatever the regulations are, how they've been adapted over time, and how the procedures are changing within a certain type of unit. The scientific review then is quite varied. That's really an experience type of approach. There obviously is an educational part to it. There are, from a toxicology standpoint, there are let's call them certifications of a certain type of experience and knowledge, but it doesn't follow what you would call the standard quality assurance type of approach.
I think this is something that's really important to make the distinction for, Dale, and I appreciate that you've done this. And I'm going to read it back to you, and please tell me if I've misinterpreted. But what I hear you saying is that there is a kind of review that says, yes, the process was followed, the appropriate boxes were checked, the steps were gone through. And then there's also a process that is essentially a hood-up, skin-off review of the content of what was done in the assessment. And those are two very different things, and I think you have to kind of be careful as to what you've asked for. And Lauren, I think you touched on this a bit in talking about, you know, the where data varies, that if you get into the latter where Dale was discussing this, you know, you could have a productive argument as to whether the correct number is 9 or 11 to use your example. And I think we have to make sure that there's a distinction between those two as we talk about this. Something else you touched on, Dale, that I'd like to maybe ask the rest of the group about is, do you think there should be a continuing education requirement or a requirement for having done a certain number of these in a period of time? So that would be, you know, an experience component. Do you have any, I'm going to use the word experience again, in terms of your background for either of these two, or once certified, you're there?
I think, this is Dale again. So I think the what you call a recertification process is important, and the reason it's important is that regulation, and I'm talking now from the quality side that reviews whether or not procedures are followed and everything's in place. What typically happens is that the standard operating procedures within any kind of unit that's doing it do change over time. The regulations can be interpreted differently over time, so there could be DTSC could issue certain regulations and then later amend those regulations, or there could be some interpretation, then that becomes part of a new version. And so the recertification type of approach then expands on the time period. Let's say it's over a 2 or 3 year period, then that the person who's doing these have been active during that period of time and have done these, and then understands how either the standard operating procedures or the regulations have changed over time. So that's a relatively, I think, straightforward recertification. It's kind of the same thing we all do with, you're a registered pharmacist, or you're a board certified toxicologist, or whatever you have to be. It's the same type of thing as you recertify, that you've done the continuing education and you understand how things are changing. Certification of it from a scientific standpoint is a little bit more difficult because there are, in fact, if you look at it from a toxicology standpoint, there are international standards for competency and qualifications for toxicologists, and those require, let's just say, for instance, to be a board-certified toxicologist requires that you regain that every 5 years, and you regain it by showing your qualifications over that period of time, your continuing education, and so forth. So there's in both aspects, there is a initial certification and then a recertification to say that you're still competent.
Anyone else want to weigh in on this as to the need for continuing education recertification? Well, then let me ask this question.
I have a comment, Bill. This is Lauren.
Sorry, go ahead, Lauren.
Thanks. Just a comment that I think it will depend in part on how the system is set up. We haven't really talked about kind of the idea of the in-house AA people versus the third-party lead assessors versus these different ideas of layers of competence. So I think for anyone who would hang out a shingle for doing third-party alternatives assessment, clearly they should be held to very high standards in terms of competence and continuing education. And given that this field is really quite new and cutting edge, there are going to be a lot of changes happening. And so there'll be a lot of learning going on over the next few years, and that'll have to be reflected in a flexible system. But in terms of having people internally who can draft that that first alternatives assessment, say, within a company, the requirements may not need to be as stringent because they may be subject to some other kind of oversight. So I just wanted to make a distinction there between who we're talking about here in terms of needing these qualifications.
And Lauren, thank you for teeing that up. I have that as a question that I wanted to get into, and we'll do that next. I would just ask one more time if there are other continuing education thoughts, or if in general, I see heads nodding that it's probably good to have some kind of continuing education recertification process.
Bill, this is Todd. Yes, no, I agree with that also, that you do need to have not necessarily recertification. It's the way we do it is it's a reaccreditation of the entity that is doing the work. And I would disagree with Lauren on the fact that industry is going to have other if there's going to be a program, and if people are going to be assured that what's going to come out of the program is the same, they're going to have to follow basically the same kind of a program and have the same kind of procedures with the same kind of oversights that you have with a third party as you do internally. I mean, it's not that much more difficult to set those things up, but if you're going to have a program, the program has got to be the same, whether it's done internally in a company or externally by somebody else. You can't have two programs with two different outcomes based on two different sets of rules.
Well, let's go ahead and get into that. And Todd, I want to challenge you just a little bit here, because it seems to me that's a reasonable approach, but it could be modulated by the way the regulations are set up. Now, our question 3B talks about the requirements for review or verification by an independent third party. But let's talk about the topic that Lauren brought up and that you commented on with respect to the potential difference for in-house versus third-party practitioners here. And the reason the depth I want to go to is, should there be a difference as to whether there's qualification requirement, if there is a mandatory third-party validation, versus whether you as an in-house person can submit it on essentially your own recognition. Does that matter, Todd? Does it matter whether you've got a forced third-party check at the end of it?
Well, I think before we go there, I think, Bill, we have to look at what DTSC is saying with regards to their capability of doing a review or a verification, even if it's on a spot basis internally. And that's the different way between the way the ANSI system is set up in greenhouse gases and the way ARB is set up. ARB is the final arbitrator and does that kind of thing, whereas in the ANSI system, it's the verification bodies that do it under the guidance of ANSI reporting back up through. And so it depends on what system DTSC is going to put in place to run this program and ensure that there's the quality is there through a verification program and spot audits that they would do. So I agree with you. It can be taken care of by regulation and how the regulation is. But you still go back to, you've got to have the same people doing of the same relative competency doing the verification, no matter where it's done. And you basically have to have people following the same basic programs, or you're going to get different results.
Other thoughts? Difference between in-house certification versus third party?
This is Joe Guth. I just want to first second the or third or fourth the agreement that we do need a continuing education program of some kind, particularly because I think the way alternative analyses are going to be done will evolve. Obviously, it's not very well established now, and I think we can anticipate a lot of changes, and so people need to be kept up to speed on that. Now, on this specific question, I guess in my mind it depends a little bit on the degree of what the verifier is doing. If it's a sort of procedural check the boxes, then absolutely the original producers of the analyses have to be trained, competent, certified. But if the third party is doing a more substantive review, then I don't know, that may open up possibility for a difference, although I wouldn't think a company would want to get itself in a position where you're going to end up with different results than the third party reviewer would come up with.
Other thoughts?
This is Lauren. I think the point I was trying to make was exactly that, is the level of expertise and qualifications depends in great part on what the verification program includes. So, for example, internally, you won't have the same requirements about managing external confidential business information and things like that, because you'll be doing this only for your own company. But you should clearly have the same basic scientific capabilities and be using the same handbook, so to speak, in terms of how you do the assessment work. But I'd also like to say that this is a really hard question, because there is a whole spectrum of possibilities. And there are some programs, for example, food safety, where the audit process involves auditing the policies and procedures of the assessors. So you don't actually go in and check every piece of beef that comes out of a meat processing plant for bacteria, but you audit all of the policies and procedures used by the packaging plant to ensure that the quality that comes out is adequate. And in other cases, you may, you know, the other extreme would be to basically redo the work of the alternative assessment on a sort of spot check basis or maybe continual basis to make sure there's agreement on every significant endpoint. And obviously that would be double the cost and time and everything else. So there needs to be some kind of sweet spot here in terms of auditing policies and procedures and then checking individual data. And again, finding ways to leverage those data. Perhaps, you know, this is where the hazard assessment databases come in to so that this information can be shared and people will be using the same information. But I think we need to probably draw a line in the sand in terms of, you know, it may not be DTSC who does any of this auditing. There may be others who are really doing the auditing work and providing the third-party services so that DTSC only has to check boxes given the availability of resources. And maybe that's somewhere we need to start from.
And it seems to me that this question about whether there are differences in requirements depends largely on how you answer question 3B, and it's going to be difficult to pull these apart. I want to stay on this topic for the time being, and I recognize that we're going to spill over into 3B as we have the discussion, and I will call for any further comments when we get, you know, past this question 3A into 3B, but, you know, these two kind of blend together. I think the thing that strikes me about this, going back to, you know, the days a million years ago when I was involved in some of the new quality evaluations that you know came out, the statistical quality control and so on in the 1980s, there was an admonition against checkers, and the idea of having 200% or 300% quality control as being the best way to do things. And the reason for that, at least in terms of the flow, was if you have three people doing the same job, one in back of the other, then the first guy in line knows that he doesn't have to be very careful because there's two people checking him. And the last guy in line says, well, I don't have to be very careful because two people have done this before me. So you have to, the quality assurance process has to take into account the idea that simply because you check it a number of times doesn't necessarily mean that your quality gets better, and that the question is deeper than that. And so with that said, I think my first thought is that you could reasonably have different requirements in terms of certification, not necessarily in terms of general competency or as someone noted, the reputation of an operation, but certainly there could be a difference in the certification of someone doing the first analysis in-house versus someone who would be auditing, whether it's an audit to see whether the boxes are checked or a total audit of the information. Frankly, if you're going to have auditors taking the entire assessment apart and checking the information, then there's no point in doing it in the first place. You might as well just have the auditor do it. So that gets to my thought about 100% or 200 or 300% QC. And I think it we have to give enough thought to this. We being DTSC, I suppose, to make sure that you devise a process that gets the most out of that process, generates the highest quality product at the lowest expenditure of expense, same time is protective of CBI and other information that we've mentioned. It's not desperately easy. So I guess To answer my own question, I think you could reasonably have different requirements for in-house versus third-party validators if you chose to modulate it by the way you set up the entire process for the system.
Bill?
Yes, sir.
This is Ty. Before we go further, could Odette give us an idea of what the agency thinks is going to be their system with regards to their involvement with doing either verification, auditing, or where they're coming from, as opposed to us just speaking about big things and big ideas as opposed to what they may actually be thinking about? And how do I put my phone on mute, because I'm going to have to get in a car here in a minute?
Well, this is Odette. We can't see your phone, so we don't know how to tell you to do that.
What you do is you put it under your arm.
This is the operator. You can press *6 to mute and unmute your line, sir.
Thank you, operator. So, as to your
thank you, operator.
About DTSC's involvement, which obviously goes to resources, and I think the safest assumption at this point in time is that DTSC will have very little resources to do either, pre-review, like work plans, so that is a possibility, and even post-review. We certainly should not envision that DTSC will be able to do any kind of an in-depth review of all AAs. I think what we envision is that we would do some sort of a check-the-box thing. Does it include all the components that the regulations say it must? I think we will be doing that, certainly. If we're lucky, if we have resources, we may, on a spot basis, do some post-audits, but we certainly don't want to become a bottleneck in terms of AAs going forward for implementation.
Odette, do you imagine that the state would be in charge of the certification of people doing these kinds of things if there were a process, or would you imagine delegating that to some other entity?
Oh, I think we will need to delegate. That's why in the draft regulations that I included as an attachment, you'll see the concept we have there, recognizing our limited resources, is that the only thing that we would certify or approve would be I can't remember what we called them, authorizing bodies or something like that. Anyway, we would be setting the standards and approving other entities that would, in fact, implement whatever sort of certification program there might be in place. Now, one of the concepts that we had is that the regulations would set out what the standards were, not only for, the lead assessors, people actually doing the work, if we're going to have standards for them, but also set out standards for the bodies that would be assisting or third parties. So there is just no way. I mean, for this to work, there's going to have to be an incredibly large number of lead assessors and, over time, third-party verifiers. And there's just no way that DTSC is going to have the resources to individually do those certifications and accreditations.
This is Bill. I just want to add that in the ARB model, of them being the final arbiter, they were able to do that because they actually got additional staff. And so while we like that concept, no one is offering that up to DTSC at this point. So, I mean, should that happen in the future, then you might be able to see a much more in-depth role of DTSC coming in.
Bob, did you want in here?
Yeah, I thought that we discussed pretty heavily in the carpet development days and moved away from, because there was a request from the end users, basically the design community, for independent third-party audits, was this concept of sign-off on, in this case, an alternatives assessment by an officer of the company. And the way that this might get coupled together to maybe tackle this challenge going forward, and I throw it out there for a little bit of intellectual debate here, is that, if there were to be a list compiled as a starting point of those individuals, organizations, institutions that are seen as qualified or capable or experienced today to conduct these audits, for which you don't have to go and deal with a checker of the checker, so to speak, Bill, to use your analogy, and at the same time you required executive officer sign off on these alternative assessments. Could we move the ball down the field here without getting too wound around the axle with all the specific details going forward? Now, I'm going to say that with the following qualification. When we start talking about auditors and certification of auditors and checking of materials and stuff like that, ultimately, my example is the financial community, probably the most highly audited, you know, institution in the world. And we still see problems. So trying to put all these checks and balances in place may not necessarily get us where we want to go, but by asking somebody at the executive officer level of a corporation to sign off on it, you know that the chances of something like that happening is probably greatly diminished. You know, we don't want to deal with the Bernie Madoffs of the world or the John Scushies or whatever their names were. But most people, you got to think, are going to come forward with the kind of veracity we need to make this a program of success. So by asking for officer signatures, there's sort of an extra check process will take place within the company or the auditors that conduct these alternative assessments.
And I'd like to take off from that for a minute if I could, Bob, because I think that's a very good suggestion. I've found that when I've gone to the president of the company and asked him to sign off on something that I've done, he actually takes rather a larger interest on the quality of that than he does if I'm not asking him to sign off on it. So for the most part, I think that's an important additional internal check that may be as important as requiring a certain level of education or certification for someone internally doing it. And I guess my approach to this would be that there ought to be, because this is an evolving discipline, if you will, that I would look more for individuals or organizations to be able to take coursework and demonstrate that you have completed the course of study that then would at least qualify you to do this sort of work, that without necessarily the need for testing or licensure or other aspects of it. And the reason for this is because ultimately these things, I imagine, are going to be public in some fashion or another. I have a hard time imagining that they wouldn't public, at least to some extent. Which means that when they become public, there's yet another check that's going to be added to it from at least two places. One would be from public interest organizations, and two would be from competitive commercial organizations. My guess is there's going to be plenty of checking that goes on when these things happen, and it's probably not. You probably don't need to create an enormous superstructure beyond setting some sort of ground rules for what constitutes education on how to do this process.
Bill, this is Odette. Let me ask a question there on your last thought.
Certainly.
So do you and others on the phone really envision that in most cases that the alternative assessments, that most of the information that goes into those, the analysis, the data, will be publicly available and not subject to trade secret claims, at least enough so that they could be checked, verified by interested parties in the public?
Well, since you were asking me, what I will say is I am sure that there will be some trade secret aspects associated with this that legitimately have to be honored, and that presents a different question. But I, just from having been involved with this process, I have a hard time imagining that the balance would be more on a trade secret basis rather than less on a trade secret basis. I think that at least the way the process seems to be going, that the reality will be that much of the information will at least much of the information will be public. That's my guess.
Okay. This is Lauren. I'd like to touch on a couple of things that Bill said and also Odette's last question. One of the things that is rather elegant, I think, about the DFE chemical alternatives assessment method is the option to provide complete hazard profiles of chemicals in a formulation or even a material, but to also have the option to hide the actual percent that is there or the exact identification of the chemical versus by a chemical name or CAS number So it allows you to still reveal the results of alternatives assessment, in this case hazard, comparative hazard assessment, without and to protect CBI information. So I think it is possible to reveal a lot of what is most relevant and of interest to the public without sort of spilling the beans on the confidential formulation information to competitors.
So, Lauren, let me ask a clarifying question. Then what you would do under those circumstances would be to say something on the order of long-chain aliphatic carboxylic acid with this toxicity rather than to say, you know, lauric acid or something of this variety.
Exactly, exactly. And if you look at the DFE partnership reports and the DFE chemical alternatives assessment method, you'll see exactly that. Some of the chemicals, you know, there's, you know, in a formulation, there's often, you know, generics that are there, and they're revealed by cast number and concentration. But some things are very important to the performance and are revealed exactly how you describe, and with a general name, no cast number, and no, and maybe a rough range of concentration.
This is Joe Guth. I'd like to say something about this. I mean, that's a really, this is a critical question, and how much meaningful public review will there be of these assessments at some point? I'm not sure what to think about it because, you know, I think there will be CBI and trade secret information obviously involved in these. Companies can choosing to designate as much information as possible as CBI can effectively keep meaningful review out of the public domain and away from competitors. So I guess you could see the incentives for people, you know, to do that. You know, it just avoids a whole another level of review after having gone through these sort of more expert kinds of reviews. But I want to suggest, and I've sort of been waiting for the right moment, because, I mean, we might think about having two different tracks for this whole process. One which could apply to situations where no CBI is claimed at all, no trade secret or CBI, so that if a company, you know, does an alternatives assessment and doesn't claim CBI, so the entire thing is publicly available, maybe we can rely on public, NGOs, competitors to police the way they're done and not require, you know, an independent third-party kind of review. So that sort of, you know, division then would cause companies to think about, well, how important is this CBI exactly, and is it important enough to then, you know, they're going to have to pay for these third-party reviews, which are probably not going to be cheap at the end of the day. But if they're doing it because the CBI, you know, is valued in such a way that justifies that, I guess there's something appealing to me about the idea of, first of all, obtaining public review where it's possible, but actually having companies think about the true value of information as CBI and not just default to the claims, at least in part to remove things from public scrutiny.
No, that's a very creative idea. Let me put it in the context of what Lauren brought up, which I see as being sort of a halfway between and CBI. How would you feel about that process with the idea of generically specifying a component and providing what amounts to an exact hazard assessment without providing the exact name of the material?
Well, you know, I'd have to think about that and see how that works. I mean, I think in principle you could imagine, having enough information to do a meaningful review of an alternative assessment that does protect some core level of information, CBI. So maybe I could qualify what I said and saying instead of if there's no CBI, then it's public review. But say if only certain information is claimed to CBI, and we felt that information that was
removed from the public domain was not necessary to the alternative assessment, then on the other hand, maybe why would that even need to be part of the alternative assessment? Chemical compounds, I guess the thing that gives me a slight pause about chemical compounds is that if you don't know the compound, then maybe you don't know the exact studies that are being evaluated, and there's always going to be different judgments about studies, and so, you know, it seems like if you're really going to have enough, you know, all the hazard information, I don't know, don't you need to know what the compound is, or don't you end up knowing what it is? But, I mean, I guess I'd be open to that general concept and principle.
I think it's a very interesting conversation, and thank you. Let me ask if there's, we are now at about a quarter of, 11 on the West Coast. I want to break one more topic under question 3A and at least get that cleared before we have the break at 11. Is there more thoughts? Are there more thoughts that you have associated with the conversation that we've had to this point?
Yeah, Bill, this is Jay.
Okay.
In terms of what Lauren said, the genetic name, I personally like that because in many cases, formulated items can be revealed, information about chemicals, for example. And then I like to go a little further in terms of assembled product, for example. We may think about genetics in formulated chemicals versus in assembled. I would like to introduce like a commonality of the parts that they used for a particular product. That means that we can rely on internal information from the individual companies of most parts, which is called common parts that introduced or used for similar assembled product, so that we can not overlooking, but at least we can make the process simpler.
I want to ask a clarifying question here, Jay, because I want to see how far this goes.
Okay.
So, for example, if there was perhaps a lousy example, and tell me if it's true.
Uh-huh.
For example, if you were using a toxic metal as part of a hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
That the part that you might have to specify would be the part that uses the metal, but not necessarily the entire design of the drive. Is that sort of what you're getting at?
Correct. For example, when my company, let's say, introduces some approval from agency, and then I will tell, okay, this is a PWB using. Assembled into the functional product using, the tin, silver, copper, no lead contained. Then there is no reason for auditor or the certified third party really take a look into, that particular, the soda paste, let's say, right? So because it already comply with the current regulations.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Jay. Others on this topic up to this point?
Yeah, this is Dale.
Yeah.
So, first of all, if you have a chemical and you have information on hazard and everything else, it's fairly easy to reverse engineer and figure out what the chemical is, just from the information and how you can get it today versus 5 years ago. So it's not, from a confidential information standpoint, not revealing the chemical, putting it into a class, and then giving other information will actually get you to the chemical. But let me do something that I think simplifies the process a little bit. And that's starting out with the actual tools that are to be used. Because we discussed this, I can remember discussing this at a meeting about a year or a year and a half ago on this. And what's critical, I think, is to at least identify the tools that should be used, and then what's considered to be the minimal SOPs that should surround the use of those tools. And that should be something that's available to everybody and sets a standard as to what's going to be used for this type of process. So that can be then applied into continuing education courses, can be applied into certain types of training. But then everybody knows at that point what those tools are, what's to be, you know, how to use them, what are the SOPs that surround those particular tools. And it allows a, let's say, the box-checking quality control thing to be set up very nicely and to be verified within an in-house type of process.
Well, let me drive you a little bit further on that, Dale. Are you essentially saying that, and I'm going to use this as a least common denominator, that there ought to be a spreadsheet that you essentially just fill the numbers in and everybody uses the same spreadsheet?
Yeah, if you want to use a spreadsheet example, yes. It would be something where here are the tools that are, here's the minimal level of tools that have to be applied into this type of situation, and then here's the quality control or the SOPs that surround those particular tools. Then that becomes the whole in-house thing, becomes a third-party approach or whatever it happens to be, and so that everybody has a good idea of what to use and what's required within this whole process.
Who would develop that deal?
Pardon me?
Who would develop those tools?
I think it has to be, because the DTSC had that report that came in on alternative assessments. And so I think that can be done through an RFP to some groups to establish what those tools should be and how they're actually used. And I think that, for me, that would be the simplified approach on the front end of this. Now, when that's actually used, and then I will use the process that you used from an internal standpoint, work plan and everything, and that's developed, and it's developed in-house or could be developed by contracting to a consulting group that the in-house people contract to that or however they're going to do it, then that work plan, as you mentioned, signed off by an executive officer of the company. Then, now, submitting that to DTSC, and then how do you go from there? Because there's a work plan, there's this, the final submission, and everything goes in. I think that DTSC should set up a scientific review board, and maybe appoint 5 members to a scientific review board. They would meet X times a year, and they would be presented with this particular submission or a series of work plans or whatever, and then they would actually then make a recommendation and to DTSC whether or not they approve that. They would vote on it. It would be public, the voting on it, and they could go from there. So in other words, you've set up the process of how it's supposed to work. You allow it to be generated in-house by third parties or whatever, but the review is going to come later, and the review is going to take into consideration that there are standardized tools, there are people who have looked at this previously, and now there's the whole assessment, and somebody's going to make a presentation, obviously, for each one of these, the assessment of whether or not it is valid from a scientific standpoint. So what you do then is combine everything into a process that I think can easily be handled by DTSC, and you would create a scientific review board, and then you would give out, you would issue a certain number of RFPs to develop the tools, to figure out exactly how you move from a work plan to an actual submission, so that everybody knows what's expected. And what's
so, Dale, I want to make sure I understand here. The scientific review board would be involved in helping create the RFP for the toolkit, but not.
No, they would be. They would the scientific review board would actually be giving a public scientific review of the submission.
So, in essence, the science review board would take the place of third-party validators.
Yes, exactly.
I think I need to say something here. This is a very intriguing idea that nobody has mentioned or thought of before in terms of using a scientific review board. But I just do want to caution you, I think, without our having done an in-depth evaluation of it, I think it may present serious both legal and financial challenges. So I just want to throw out that caution.
Bill?
Yes.
Lauren, could I comment? I agree with some of what Dale is saying, and I think that I could imagine as he was talking, I was thinking that he was talking about this review board would review the tools that could be used as part of AA, and that would make a lot more sense in my mind, because there is no one way of doing alternatives assessment right now, and there will be a need for multiple tools. There are tools for doing chemical hazard assessment. There's tools for looking at energy consumption and carbon footprint and water consumption and social metrics and all of those things that are mentioned in the regulations that may or may not need to be included in an alternatives assessment. So there won't be any one tool, but there will be multiple tools, and they could be used together. And so I could imagine a process whereby there's a review board that would approve the use of specific tools to support alternatives assessment, because I think, you know, setting up an auditing procedure and requirements for profilers is really begging the need for some sort of standardization of alternatives assessment, and that's not where we are right now. And so I like the idea of sort of standardizing pieces of an alternatives assessment, such as the individual tools that support different pieces of alternatives assessment. And I'd like to make one other comment, too, getting back to questions 3A and 3B. We talked about the requirements of different players in the alternatives assessment, and you really helped push me off the fence, Bill, in some of your comments where I've been for a long, uncomfortable time. And that is, I'm beginning to think that all of the alternative assessments need to go through a third-party reviewer, and that third-party reviewer should be audited for their policies and procedures. Now, I also am sensitive to the time and the cost that this could cost companies, and so it's really important that if a company has, say, trained people internally who can do alternative assessment, they can save a huge amount of cost by doing all of this work internally before they give it to the third party. And the third party has a lot less to do, and therefore the cost will be reduced. But still, the AAs would go through a third party, and that third party, amongst other third parties, would be audited by either the state or by an auditor of choice to the state or from the state or by the state, whatever. And so I think that does sort of simplify things, and it allows for expertise within companies, but also it creates a sort of quality control piece by going through third parties with an option to save costs by doing it yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren. And we're right now at 11 o'clock. I'm going to save the next question that I wanted to bring up until after the break, because as I look out over the crowd here, I can see that we have hydraulic high-pressure lights showing on a number of you. So technically it says that we should give you a five-minute break. I know how that works. I'm going to reconvene at 10 after 11 Pacific time, which would be approximately 10 minutes from now, and then we'll finish the discussion after that.
Bill, I'm not going to be – this is Todd. I'm not going to be able to rejoin, but I do appreciate very much what Lauren was just saying, and that is probably a good way to help DTSC at least start on this. And so I will have to – I'm going to be missing the next hour because of a meeting. Sorry.
Appreciate that, but we, of course, have another call, and we can take
right.
up again. Thank you, Todd. All right, talk to you all again in about 10 minutes. Okay, folks, I'm going to give you your two-minute warning at this point. Okay, let's go ahead and get started again. Everyone okay with that? Everyone out there? Todd, I know, is gone.
I'm here.
Joker.
Okay, I'm here, Jay.
If you're not present, please say something. I'd like to, we've spent a fair amount of time talking about qualification kinds of requirements. I'd like to ask if there are any disqualification requirements, particularly for a third-party review organization. Examples that might qualify as disqualifications, there might, for example, be a quality disqualification, that if you've generated a number of AAs over a period of time that didn't pass a further review, that there might be a quality evaluation. Or, as was suggested in the draft regs that were put out last year, that specified that for third-party for third-party reviewers, that those third parties would have no economic interest in any entity that manufactures or places in commerce a priority chemical or priority product. Something that struck me about that is, if you become a contractor to a company as a third-party reviewer, then, you know, in a way, you're being paid by them, so you have something of a conflict. But if you are an organization that has done a review for a product in a particular space, or would you be disqualified on a conflict basis from doing a similar or even different product in the same space? Those kinds of things. So let me just leave it at that. Are there any disqualifications for people doing these kinds of evaluations?
This is Joe. Is there a way to flag that we want to say something? Did you say if we hit star one or something?
No, just go ahead and jump in. If you jump in.
Okay. Well, I think this is. I hope this is responsive to your question. We've been talking quite a lot about sort of technical qualifications of people doing these assessments, but I think we also need to keep in mind the point about, or the need for them to be actually independent financially, and also financially independent, but also independent from the point of view of the kind of just the kind of judgments that they will make. I mean, if we are having a process where, you know, that is deciding what chemicals are going to be in commerce, in products, and reach the environment in various ways, that is not really reviewable
you know, by the public because of CDI and trade secret concerns, then I think there has got to be, it's just not going to work or have credibility unless there is some level of independence in the reviewers, that people in the public and other companies actually, you know, will trust. And so part of it is technical capabilities, but part of it is independence. And so I think this goes to your point. I mean, disqualifications, I think, at least for the verification stage, need to focus heavily on the independence point.
Joe, I appreciate that, and I'm not really particularly wanting to take us down the rabbit hole on this, but my question really goes to what constitutes independence, because there, you could at least imagine that there are soft ways in being with a company, even that doesn't look like it. So, say for example, I'm a company.
Mm-hmm.
I've done my internal AA, and I'm hiring you as a third party to validate it. And I'm going to be paying you.
Right. I know it's an issue. This is a problem in the way risk assessments are done now. I mean, companies are hired to do them, and they are risk assessors. They're not product manufacturers, but they know who's paying them, and so I think it undermines their credibility. So this is what change is actually argued. I mean, it's painful because you end up thinking about other more layers of bureaucracy. But one suggestion has been that, well, companies would pay into a fund to DTSC, and then DTSC would pick the actual third parties, so that, you know, the third parties are answerable to DTSC, not the ultimate source of the funds. But again, that creates another level of bureaucracy.
Other thoughts? Thank you, Joe. That gets at the question I was asking. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is Dale.
I just want to caution everybody. We don't have the authority right now to set up that kind of program. So just a word of caution.
Yeah.
Because that looks like a fee.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think the reality of this is the third-party groups are going to be consulting groups, quite frankly. And so it's almost impossible to separate out consulting groups from, you know, getting paid from other groups to do this, because obviously you wouldn't be a consulting group unless you're paid to do it. So one of the things that you could do is you do the same way you do now for certain types of publications that come out that way. You have to, the authors have to identify potential conflicts of interest and whether or not, and who they're actually being paid by, and whether or not that has is a meaningful conflict of information for whatever's in the publication. That's been taken over now. It's kind of a standard approach with a number of journals and publications. I'll just leave it at that right now.
Other thoughts? And I see this as being one of the difficulties associated. And I'm going to bring up one other here in a minute. One of the difficulties associated with placing a third party reviewer at such an elevated level is that you are assuming that third-party review is independent and of at least as high, if not higher, quality than the original assessment, both of which are at least debatable. Other thoughts?
This is Jay. Either we or, you know, the agency, DTF, should know the so-called reputations of either consulting company or lab who can do, the respective, the field audit or, certifications. That could be one way to select and qualify.
Okay. And that reputation would be outside some sort of direct state certification. You would be suggesting that the reputation of the consulting operation would be something of a determinant as to what would be the good ones in the
like consumer protection agency report not necessarily like that, but in terms of they have integrity and didn't have any problems of their conduct previously, things like that.
I guess it's the same sort of question as you have when you're hiring any sort of contractor guy. You want to have to do concrete for you,
exactly.
Sort of the same way.
Right.
Here's another question that goes to this. If in the process that involves first internal generation of an AA, whether by a person who is certified to the same standards as the external reviewer would be or not. But what sort of adjudication process do you have if the third-party reviewer comes to largely different conclusions than the original generator of the AA comes to? And does it matter whether they're both quote-unquote certified or not? How do you decide who's right?
This is Dale. That's why I proposed to have a kind of a final scientific review board.
Of course, assuming that you could do that, doesn't this sort of devolve to the same question as when you go to the doctor and you don't like what he says and you go get a second opinion and you find out it's different?
Oh yeah, but this occurs. I will tell you quite frankly in the toxicology field, this occurs with virtually every assessment that's made. And people have different levels of experience. They have different ways to look at information, gather information, assess it. They do it both from an experience standpoint, and some of those can be within a trade secret approach. So there's there's confidential experience, there's publicly related experience. So you do end up with a differing opinion on a lot of these processes, and it doesn't relate to the qualifications of the reviewer or the training or anything else. A lot of times it relates to somebody's ability to look at something, assess it, and give their opinion. So you will have differing opinions, and that's why I still think that having it go through some kind of a scientific review board, you can call it that if you want to, but some type of a scientific review board that is, in fact, independent. Independently constructed by whatever you feel the best approach to do that.
I know with the DFE program, I agree with Dale, this happens all the time, and I have experience with both DFE and then the green screen for safer chemicals program. And in the case of DFE, because they're the ones who are putting their label on a product, they serve as a kind of arbiter of hazard assessment information, and usually it becomes sort of educational. It may be that one profiler just missed it, and so they, both profilers will be involved in a situation where there isn't agreement, and they'll learn if there was information missing, and then they'll come to agreement on what the value or interpretation should be. And I know with the green screen work we're doing, we've set up a program where someone can have a product assessed and then have a third party do the validation work. And there are cases where there's disagreement, but often when they talk to each other and share what they know, they are able to come to agreement themselves. We have not yet come to a point where the two assessors can't come to agreement. And I'm sure that will happen, but I think there could be a process of sort of revisiting judgments together that will eliminate at least a good portion of the disagreement. And then there may be, as others on the call have said, a need for kind of an arbitration. But again, that also gets to the idea of, is there a way to share some of the basic information that is not proprietary and not, say, product-specific, and that could be hazard information or generic information on materials and carbon footprints or whatever it may be. To what extent can the qualified third parties share this information so knowledge will be increased and harmonization of results will be increased?
Taking sort of a cynical view of the last part of this conversation, and I throw it out not to be any more untoward than I usually am, but let's just walk through what we just talked about. We talked about doing an alternatives assessment. Presumably, we're going to start by doing this with in-house resources. We've talked about then submitting it to, in some fashion, a third-party organization also who is then certified in the process for review. And if there's a disagreement, then there has to be a third independent science review board that acts as the arbiter. And I can already see Odette reaching for the phone that there's not necessarily a way that DTSC would operate that. But my question is, If I've got to go to that final review board anyway, why do I need the independent outside validator?
Well, because we may have a lot. There may be a lot of the independent review board may have a much smaller number of issues to deal with than if they have to do everything. They would just be reviewing disputes. So you could, but you know, you've posed a question, Bill, in the context of sort of a scientific disagreement. But there could also easily be disagreements about how to implement the just the decision making process. The protocols for doing the assessments could easily end up with different ways to interpret them. So I wonder if DTSC would be the logical party to resolve disputes like that, because in part they may need to revise the protocols.
Well, and of course the 50 new people they'll be hiring to do this will be the ones to take care of that, right, Odette?
Well,
that is correct, Bill.
Okay. I mean, if the two, if the two, maybe there should be some obligation on the original assessors to try to work it out. If they can't, then I'll then go. But, a science advisory panel board would sort of be a creature of DTSC's anyway, wouldn't it?
Well, you would think it would have to be, and once again, modulated by the resources that they would have to work with it. But I'm just trying to follow this track down, because
yeah,
it gets back to my point about checkers checking checkers.
Mm-hmm.
Get to the point where an infinite series of reviews does not necessarily give you clarity. And that's why I'd like to challenge us to think through the process as to whether there are ways of getting to relative clarity that don't necessarily involve an infinite series of checks.
Well, Bill, perhaps, a variation of that, and again, I would reiterate that, if there's a disagreement and people sit down with all their information and discuss it, the odds are they will be able to resolve it. But let's say, for example, the third party trumps the internal assessment. Even then, if that creates a hierarchical approach, you would still need, I think, some process for dispute resolution. If you just think the third party is really out to lunch and you absolutely disagree, there may need to be some sort of process whereby you can dispute their work. But I agree with you. The checkers checking checkers does not make sense, and we may need to prioritize.
And let me just take that a step further, Laura, and make sure that I've characterized this correctly. I posited this starting internally, then to an external reviewer, and then if there's a science review board, to that science review board. If the science review board, if the prejudice is going to be in favor of the outside entity, and my recourse is, because I've done my own assessment, is to appeal it to that scientific review board, it almost says to me that I shouldn't even bother doing this internally. I might as well just go to the outside person in the first place. If there's going to essentially be a prejudice in favor of
well, but, you know, aren't we envisioning that these alternative assessments ultimately become part of product development, you know, strategies as companies are designing products, developing substitutes, that they will look at a range of alternatives as part of their product development? I mean, they're going to have to be doing some of this internally.
Well, maybe yes, maybe no. It depends on whether you have the capability to develop those new products. But I agree with you. There's certainly that thought associated with this. The other question that I have that comes to this is, ultimately, when you've done your alternatives assessment and you get to the end, and maybe this is in the quality aspect or not, but there's going to be a decision made about which one of the two is better and what you do about it. And this question for some group, and Odette, correct me if this is not in ours, and I'll stand down, is how do you know? What is enough better to be better and to be a preferred alternative? And doesn't that at least to some extent depend on the quality of the process that you've had leading up to that and exactly the things we're talking about?
Well, I think, Bill, it's Odette, I think whether or not this is a topic for this group depends on a larger question, because what I've heard among the discussion that's been going on recently is what I'm hearing as an assumption that the third-party verifier would opine on the decision that comes out of the alternatives assessment process. And that's a question. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be set up that way. So that is probably the bigger question for you to address. You know, you could have just the third-party reviewer doing what some of you have talked about before, is reviewing the process, the data, the analysis. Is it sound? You know, are there errors there? Are there conflict? But the ultimate decision by the manufacturer in terms of which alternative they're going to pick, you know, does the verifier get to weigh in on that?
Well, that's actually adding another layer of complexity that we haven't touched on with respect to the third-party reviewers.
Uh-huh.
Hey, Bill.
And if I could read it back to you, it's process, science, and conclusion. Go ahead, Bob.
So, again, this is one of these pretty sticky wickets here, but I'm sort of thinking of a model where perhaps we go back to a comment I made earlier, and that is some effort is put into establishing a list or a group of accepted independent reviewers, auditors, or people that are qualified or capable of carrying out the alternative assessment. And at the end of the day, it's somebody from that group that's been, I'm going to use the term, vetted by the DTSC or a science review board, however you want to do that, that you say, we're going to accept the outcome of these people's assessment or their opinion of an assessment. So a company can do their own assessment and then to go to one of these people on the list and get a validation of it, or they can hire somebody on this list to do the assessment, and that's what gets presented to DTSC for, you know, an acceptance at that point in time. Now, I want to couple that with this idea of a science review committee, and I know there's concerns about staffing and money to do that, but my analogy here is the NSF International out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. They have created a voluntary committee who basically meets virtually, who oversees every standard that's promulgated by NSF International that goes forward to ANSI for, what's the right word, not administration, but final publication for use. It becomes an ANSI standard. And the CPHC, Council of Public Health Professionals, CPHC, will make the final call on this. So you could have this oversight committee basically review and agree to this grouping of approved vendors to provide this service, and that if there's something that's not accepted by somebody that submits an alternative assessment, maybe it rolls up to this oversight committee for some type of, quote, arbitration.
I'd also like to add one other small bit of complexity, and I hope we can get ourselves a little bit out of the complexity here in a couple of minutes. But one bit of complexity that is a reality from someone who, speaking from my industry background, it's not difficult to imagine that the decisions being made here get to be billion-dollar decisions. And so it gets to be, at least for some members of the process, something that really does have importance and more than an academic interest. So how this gets done, decisions, I think is going to be absolutely critical in terms of not just the impact on companies who were involved in it, but also the credibility of and the ability to execute the program itself. This gets to be, I think, some fairly important detail in the overall process.
Bill, I think that's a very good point. This is Lauren, and I just want to sort of counter something you said by saying that I don't think you should assume that the internal information generated internally will be weighted less heavily than the external information. In my experience with green screen assessments, the suppliers of materials often have a lot more information and a lot more data than what are available publicly. So if you were to just go to a third-party profiler, you would only get what was known publicly. If you take what you have internally to a third-party profiler, they're now able to use internal information that they didn't have access to before, and that's really important. And as trained professionals, they're going to evaluate that information based on the quality of the information. Is it, you know, valid test data or whatever? But that will certainly weigh into their assessment. So I think that having doing the work internally will actually carry a huge amount of weight and benefit the organization to bring that forward to a third party.
Other thoughts in this general area? Then let me take it. I'm going to skip question 3C because I think a natural follow-on to where we are right now is question 3D. To the extent DTSC has resources available to post-audit AAs, what should be the focus of those audits? Now, once again, this is postulating that there exist resources. Is that the sort of thing, do you imagine DTSC checking each one, spot checking, picking those that are close calls? If you had the resources and you were DTSC, how would you add your own quality process, quality assurance process to this?
Bill, this is Jay. If I recall the exercise in terms of alternative assessment, there are some matrix to approve or disapprove the alternates. So what if this ETSC look at that matrix total, and if the number is greater than X, and then DTSC automatically review. If the number matrix is lower than X, then it's approved. So if we use that exercise of decision making, whether DTS has a sufficient the power to approve or disapprove based on that the matrix.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Jay. Other thoughts?
So this is Dale. So the question 3D is this primarily based around resource availability?
Well, it's obviously it's based on two things, Dale, at least as I imagine it. One is assuming that there are some resources available for this, which is rather a heroic assumption at this time. But let's if you were to have those resources, how would you manage them in this process to get the maximum quality assurance for the minimal amount of resource? Would you imagine spot checking and doing extensive review on the occasional AA? Would you imagine doing a cursory check on each of them? Which approach would you take if you had at least some resources to work from?
Well, let me answer that, because I mean if the process is set up where there's standardized tools, there's SOPs, there's qualifications of individuals that are actually doing it, that to me is sufficient in terms of the review. And I still like the idea that the process goes to this time I'll call it a voluntary scientific review board, and then that becomes kind of the final process to say, yes, everything was followed, it is scientifically correct, and we give our stamp of approval to it. I don't think you have to go internally and do certain types of quality audits on the data, because you've set up the tools, you've set up the process, you've set up the qualifications, and that should be a sufficient approach to get there.
Other thoughts?
I think, this is Joe Guth. DTC probably needs to do some, at least occasional review of the various assessors to provide some oversight of them. Just so they know they have to be as part of the certification. I think DTSC is going to have to be involved in some level, and certification, oversight, quality control by spot checking. And then another thing they might focus on is a case where we talked about earlier, if places where there are disputes between different assessors, that would be a place where I think DTSC's guidance would be useful.
So you would see the preferred approach that you would take would be more of a process check rather than a check of the final product in some fashion.
Well, I think they should try to do a substantive check on the work of the different assessors, at least as a spot check. But I mean, periodically, all the assessors ought to have their work subject to DTSC review on occasion.
And that review, you mean for scientific accuracy?
Yeah, I guess a fairly thorough review.
Okay.
This is Lauren. I agree with Dale and Joe, and I think it would be very helpful for DTSC to develop templates for the third parties to use. And I think it makes sense for DTSC to play more of an oversight/governance role, and really to audit the policies, SOPs of the third parties. And doing spot checks is a good way to assess the third parties as well. And that could be the work of auditors, or DTSC directly. So I think you could kind of combine that spot checking to assess the various third parties.
Okay. Other thoughts on DTSC and its hypothetical resources? If not, then let's go ahead and take question 3C. The question is, what should be included in AA work plans submitted to DTSC in advance of the commencement of the AA itself? And as you think about this, I have always imagined that the work plan would be something of an outline of the approach that you would use. Some of the things that you might think about in this context is, what should the detail be in the outline? Should it be as detailed as you imagine the full AA would be? Should there be data included in the work plan as sort of a rough sketch of where the final AA would be going? And what should be the validation, if you will, of that work plan other than if it goes to DTSC to say, yeah, it looks okay to me? Is that a place where a third-party reviewer should also have a chop at it? Any thoughts in this area?
Yeah, this is Dale. So a work plan tends to be a draft outline of a process that's going to take place. And what happens with every work plan is that it's revised as more information comes in or you're looking at it slightly differently. So you can't view it as the final process. You can only look at it as a draft outline of what's going to take place, but you've got to realize it's going to change over time.
Two questions, Dale. First, how is the work plan modulated if you have a standard set of tools as you've suggested? And second, what percentage of the overall cost of the project would you imagine would get spent on the work plan versus the entire project?
I would say the work plan is one of the things you're going to do in a work plan is you're going to define the actual tools that are going to be applied to the situation that's under review. So if you have, 25 different tools, then you're picking tool 17, 18, and 19 to do this particular process. And then I don't see it as being a major expense to say what's going to happen in terms of that. And again, this goes back to the fact that I'm assuming there's going to be standardized tools and those will be identified.
So do you imagine it would be sort of 20% on the work plan and 80% on the final?
Oh, yeah, at least 80% on the final.
I see. Work plan really is just a basic sketch. Other thoughts?
In my view, I think it would be.
Okay, thank you. Lauren, is there in DFE, is there any work plan requirement beforehand, or you just go right to the end?
Well, it depends on, for the formulator program, there really are just forms that you fill out to provide the necessary information in a consistent way. So again, back to that idea of a template that would make it really much easier to compare the work of different profilers and third parties. If you're talking about the public DFE partnerships, that's a really different situation because you're convening a whole lot of stakeholders and there's a lot of pre-planning that goes in terms of defining which alternatives are relevant and which are confidential and which aren't, things like that. But that's very much a sort of dynamic process, and it's a multi-stakeholder process. So I'd have to say that's really different from just going to have a product reviewed confidentially by a third party. I don't know
okay.
if that answers your question.
Yep. Other thoughts on the work plan? I can see I've pretty well worn you out.
Well, I think the question of the work plan really has to do, is there anything really important that's not in the work plan that should be there, and is there anything maybe that could be cut out that doesn't need to be there? So I know, Jay was talking earlier about components, right? You know, that if you're doing an alternatives assessment on something in an electronic product, you may not have to look at the whole electronic product. You may just have to look at some component of it. So I think the work plan is really a chance to make sure you're not you know, doing more work than you have to, but make sure you're not skipping anything really critical. That takes some expert judgment, I think.
Well, my question would be, if and I guess the second part of this is, are these work plans going to be reviewed by DTSC or a third party? And if they're not, I wonder. I mean, are they still useful to do? I mean, obviously somebody needs to scope out the work they're going to do before they do it, but does it need to be submitted to DTSC if it's not going to be reviewed?
Excellent question, Joe. Odette, how would you imagine that?
Well, we were imagining that these work plans would be submitted to DTSC for review, but it would be pretty much a checkbox review to ensure that the plan that was laid out looked like it was going to meet the requirements of the statute and the regulations.
Would it, in the event where you would have a third-party reviewer that at the end of the process, let's say someone had an inadequate work plan and brought forward an inadequate product, wouldn't that pretty much be rejected by the third-party reviewers as being inadequate and once again save you a step and let you know that you get it right the first time rather than having to submit a work plan and have someone take a chop at it?
Well, again, this goes back. You're talking about the end result, the conclusion?
Yeah, what I'm questioning is, as I ask these questions, I'm looking for steps.
Yeah.
That may be redundant in the context of an overall process, and if there are redundant steps, that in eliminating them doesn't take away from the overall quality, then maybe it takes some cost out of the process. And my basic underlying assumption here is, the more difficult and costly you make the alternatives assessment process, the fewer alternatives assessments you're going to get.
Right. In terms of the conclusion, I talked earlier about the question of whether or not the third-party verifier looks at the conclusion, but there's another bigger question, which probably is more purview of one of the other subcommittees, and it's probably a big policy question as well, is whether or not DTSC passes judgment on the conclusion of the manufacturer's AA.
Yep.
Well, at some point, DTSC has got to get involved because there's a whole issue of regulatory responses, which I assume is going to come up at some point. I mean, this whole program cannot just be completely, you know, beyond the DTSC's involvement.
No, you're absolutely right, Joe. I mean, you know, we have always envisioned that the selection of regulatory response will in some way be affected by the conclusion made in the AA by the manufacturer. So the question that I'm raising is, does DTSC, separate and apart from the regulatory responses, do we pass judgment on and set ourselves up with the ability to approve or disapprove the AA decision put forward by the manufacturer?
Yeah, you know, I mean, this would be speculative, but it's easy to, you could imagine situations where the alternative chosen is connected to limitations, restrictions, basically alternative response, different regulatory responses, you know. So, in other words, one chemical might be safer under certain circumstances than another, but it sort of depends on those circumstances being imposed. And so, you know, there are a lot of policy issues, you know, involved in that, what's implementable and all kinds of things. And I guess I would think that DTSC ought to form an opinion about that. So it's hard for me to, maybe it's, you can imagine circumstances where they don't need to be involved in the final decision, but you can also imagine some where the final decision would raise issues that DTSC should think about.
Let's do the following. We're coming up on 5 minutes to noon, and at least coming close to the end of our allotted time. What I'd like to propose for going forward is, first of all, recognizing that our next call, Odette, is the 16th. Do I have that correct?
Yes, you do.
So we have a leisurely 2 weeks plus prepare for the next call. What I'd like you to do, if you would, please, is with respect to homework, I'd like you to go back over the questions. And we've touched on all of the questions today. We got further on this than I really thought that we would. I'd like you to think back over the conversation, and particularly each of you had some things that were, as I remember, were very important for you. And I'd like you to capture them as aspects of this process that you feel will be important, whether it's in terms of the qualification requirements for people conducting the AAs, the process with respect to whether it can start internally and be externally validated, or other aspects of it, whether there's a need for an independent third-party review, and if so, under what circumstances, what DTSC's role at the end would be given adequate resources, and I'm once again not hypothesizing infinite resources, but adequate resources to accomplish it. And to the extent of the process involving the work plan, I'd like you to capture those thoughts in no more than a page to a page and a half. And also to the extent that it works that you can draw block diagrams or process diagrams, I think those would help as well. I'd like to ask that you generate these and submit them to DTSC within, what, a week? Odette, how much time do you need for turnaround and evaluation?
Well, if we do it the way we did it last time, which actually I think worked very well, is they just submit them, you know, shortly before the phone call, and then each member kind of presents that at the beginning of the phone call, and then the subcommittee as a whole discusses them. And then after the phone call, if anybody wants to tweak what they have submitted, we would at that time specify a deadline, which probably would be a matter of a couple of days.
Okay, that's fine, and that's exactly the process that I wanted to that I wanted to give, but I also wanted to give you a date. Could we say that within 10 days, which would be, what, the 10th of June, to capture your thoughts and send them to DTSC, but recognize that you're also going to use them to start the discussion for the next call? Is that acceptable to you all?
Yep.
And once again, I'm not looking for you to fill a 64-page blue book here, something that amounts to 300 to 500 words tops.
Bill, I'd like to ask your subcommittee members to please put your name at the top of the document.
Yeah, thank you for the reminder, Kathy.
What that means is you can't get credit for your paper unless you put your name on it.
That's right.
Oh, we will make sure you get credit. It just takes a little bit of cut and paste for us if we don't have the name.
Well, I haven't heard any screams, so I'm going to just go right to the conclusion and assume that that's all right. Are there other things that need to be said at this point? First of all, I want to congratulate you all on what I think has been a very, very interesting and innovative call. This is it's always fun to play with this group. It's like, you know, getting an old Ferrari and driving it, at least intellectually. Other thoughts for the group at this point?
No, I will echo Bill. I thank you very much. This really has been very stimulating. And Bill always thinks that his subject matters are not going to take up the full time, and they always do, and they're always very interesting. So thank you.
Thank you all.
All right.
Very good. Then we'll dismiss the rest of the group. Odette, I'm going to stay on, and we can debrief about anything that needs to happen from here, if that's all right.
Yeah, I can do it for about 5 minutes.
That's all I need.
Thanks for chairing, Bill.
Thank you, Bill. Good job.
Believe me. Thank you all very much for your time, and take care.
Bye. Okay.